Hello and welcome to Unstress. My name is Dr. Ron Ehrlich. Now, before I start, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which I am recording this podcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, who for over, tens of thousands, almost 65,000 or more years, have been the custodians of the land on which I am recording this podcast. The Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I would like to pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Well, today we are going to reflect on the pandemic and all that led up to it, how it was managed, and all that passed after it, or some of the past after it. I mean, the pandemic was an opportunity for global reflection, so I thought it would be a good opportunity to reflect on that because there are so many interesting lessons to learn, sobering lessons to learn about the pandemic and the way it was managed, the way it was perceived, and the way it is still being looked at. My guest today is Professor Ian Brighthope. Now, Ian's been a great mentor of mine for over 30 years, and has been a guest on the podcast before. He has a lifelong interest in nature and health. He graduated in agricultural science in 1965, and then in 1974 graduated with a Bachelor of Medicines and Bachelor of Surgery. So he's a medical practitioner. He's been a clinician for over 40 years and a passionate advocate for health and all that can promote our natural immunity. Yes, we talk about natural immunity in this podcast. It's still an important thing, even though you could be excused during the pandemic for wondering whether it existed at all. As a founding president of the Australasian College of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine, ACNEM, and he was president for over 26 years, Ian pioneered the first postgraduate medical course in nutrition and the environment and environmental science and its related fellowship in Australia. He's now an official ambassador for ACNEM. Look, Ian has published extensively, appeared publicly as an advocate in front of governments, in front of conferences. He's been teaching literally thousands of dentists and doctors and health practitioners nutritional and environmental medicine for over 40 years. We discuss many issues, including the pandemic, what emergency use authorizations mean, the significance of it in fast-tracking experimental medications like the mRNA vaccine through to the public. You know, we congratulated ourselves on, or the narrative in the media congratulated us on how quickly we had got this vaccine out. Isn't it a wonder of modern medicine? Well, it's a wonder of modern marketing. The reason things take 5 to 10 years to get through is because we like to know that what we have is safe. And the beauty of an emergency use authorization is that it absolves the manufacturer of liability. So hence, natural immunity could stand in the way of rushing through a new novel medication and a gene therapy medication of that. Look, we discuss a whole range of things. I hope you enjoy this conversation I had with Professor Ian Brighthope. Welcome back, Ian.
Thanks, John. Great to be back.
Ian, I always like to get some guests, not every guest, back for a regular chat and catch up. And I always look forward to our discussion. So I really wanted to share some of that with our listener. You know, when the pandemic occurred, I saw it in a way as an opportunity for global reflection on health, particularly as we were told that a lot of these diseases that are common would predispose us to serious problems and death. So it was a way of really focusing people on death, and taking their health very seriously. So now we're a few years after it, and I wondered if we might just reflect now. I was interested to hear your reflection of the pandemic, and I know you've been involved in a Royal Commission, which I'm hoping we can talk about as well.
Sure, Ron. I think there's an old saying, you should take every opportunity, even if there is a crisis situation because out of every crisis, you can create something better. I'm twisting words around a little bit here because it's my own little philosophy, but I think the emergence of a severe flu-like illness to be called a pandemic was something beyond the pale, and the response globally was an overreach that has long-term adverse effects on society, on our culture, on our economy, on our children, and on our health as well. I'm quite controversial when it comes to talking about this, as you probably are aware.
Well, Ian, you know, not a small part of why I enjoy talking to you and wanting to share those views with our listener, because I don't think it's a view that is heard often enough. Yeah. Go on, please.
Thanks, Ron. Well, there was right at the beginning, I knew something was quite wrong. Every epidemic that we've ever had has been badly managed, very badly managed, from bird flu, SARS, pig, swine flu, H1N1, all of the flus. They are called epidemics, and yes, they are caused by a virus known as the influenza virus. We don't look at the individual when we are looking at public health. We're looking at the whole of the public and trying to find a solution for the entire population. That solution is usually a vaccine or an antiviral drug. But individuals are ignored. Their individual health is ignored in all of this, and we're all treated the same. And that is, we've got to have a vaccine. If we get sick enough, we go to hospital and get a drug, an antiviral. If we end up in intensive care, we end up with more drugs and on a ventilator and possibly dying. Well, we've known for a long, long time, Rob, a long time, that there is very, very good science on the importance of, you know what I'm going to say, vitamin D in the prevention and defense against these viruses. Why do some people get these viruses and get sick? Some die, some end up in hospital, some end up with complications, and the majority of the population just get a simple running nose or a headache or a day of tiredness, or some people no symptoms at all. The reason is genetics, number one. Number two, lifestyle. And the most important part of lifestyle is exercise, diet, and the exposure to sunlight. And if we've got levels of vitamin D in our system and other nutrients in our system, we just don't get these viruses. Our mucus and our skin, the outside lining of our bodies is the skin. The inside lining is called mucous membranes. The mucous membranes, if they are intact, they just don't let the virus in if they're healthy. We know that the things that make mucus healthy are your vitamin D, your vitamin C, your zincs, and so forth, all of these things that occur in nature. And so we overreact, but we've overreacted because we've been told to overreact. We've been told it's a frightening virus when it wasn't really. It emerged as just a severe flu-like illness. And the authorities in the World Health Organization, who are bureaucrats, unelected bureaucrats, who are running an organization that I have severe and grave doubts about its integrity, its honesty, and its ability to look after the global health. The World Health Organization has pandemic preparedness organizations attached to it, such as CEPI, the Committee for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation. And CEPI do not have qualified people to look after individual health concerns. They're looking at what are we going to do for the next so-called pandemic or epidemic or virus? And that is, we've got to have vaccines available to combat these things, which is an absolute nonsense. Vaccines have never been shown to be safe. Yet they come out with statements that these mRNA vaccines wrapped up in a lipid nanoparticle are safe and effective. Well, they were neither safe and they were neither effective. Yes. We were promised. I mean, we'll go back to the vaccines a little bit later, if you like, Ron. Mm. We were told lies by the organisation, and we know that they're lies because we have actually that they're actually still encouraging the lies to be told. They're the most heinous lie of history ever, because the vaccines are responsible for an increased, unexplained, unexpected death rate, up to 20% in some demographies, around about 16% average.
Now, Ian, that point, which you've just said very quickly, I think we need to just pause there for a moment, because it's not a statistic that many people are hearing about, and yet it's very real. Just back up a little bit there and flesh that one out a bit more for us.
Sure, Ron. Well, when we look at the statistics, and the statistics don't lie, when we look at the statistics in the US, in Canada, in the UK, Australia, New Zealand, we see an increased unexpected death rate. And it started not during COVID. It's not due to COVID. COVID did not kill people at the rate we expected it to in 2020.
Remembering, Ian, that in 2020, we had the most virulent strain, the Delta strain, which was the worst of all the COVIDs. And that was. So that wasn't the elevated mortality rate then.
No.
But subsequent to it, the rates have gone up considerably.
That's right. Subsequent to that, and if you don't mind, I'm just going to jump out of my chair for a second and grab something that is important for your listeners.
Sure.
This was a book. It was published not so long ago.
And we're reading it because some people are on audio only, but it says, "Too Many Dead, An Inquiry into Australia's Excess Mortality," which is not just Australia's, as you've said. There have been excess mortalities of between 15 and 20% in the UK, US, in parts of Europe and in Australia. Go on. Yes.
Yes. It was published by AMPS, the Australian Medical Professionals Society, which is an alternative to the Australian Medical Association. These doctors who started AMPS are the doctors who are awake to what's going on with regard to these pandemics, so-called plandemics. The Australian Medical Association did absolutely nothing, as did the RACGP, when it came to looking after the individual's health and actually helping people to stay alive and preventing the need for a vaccine that was told would stay in the deltoid muscle, and it didn't. It spread to everywhere, including the gonads, the ovaries, testicles, and brain and heart. And that's why we're seeing so much sickness, as well as are now seeing males without any sperm. And these are young males. So the excess death rate is accompanied by all of these illnesses and diseases, including neurological diseases, myocarditis, severe heart disease, cardiac arrests in young men in particular, and like young athletes, as well as what we call turbo cancers or lightning turbo cancers, which are cancers that come back very, very rapidly and grow rapidly and kill people very quickly. And I'm sure some of your listeners, if not many of your listeners, will know of people who have died unexpectedly and died young and died from unknown causes.
But that's often, now, to play the devil's advocate here, that in the media is often described as this is a part of long COVID, and this is exactly why we have to be so scared of this pandemic. You know, this is long COVID at work here.
Well, the media are telling a lie. All of the media are telling a lie, and I'll come back to that a little bit later, because it's important to understand where this lie is coming from. But and I'm not telling stories. We've got evidence for all of the things that I'm saying now.
The Australian, I know, Ian, for example, the Australian government are currently conducting a royal commission into COVID, and I know you have presented a lot of this data, which isn't just an opinion. You know, this is backed up. Tell us a little bit about that and the Royal Commission that's going on.
Sure. Well, look, there's a number of senators who are awake to what's going on, who are aware of the adverse effects of the vaccines and aware of the fact that the government has turned a blind eye to the increased unexpected deaths. The government has actually denied on a number of occasions to have proper inquiries into these unexplained excessive deaths. And so the senators who are looking at all of the data from around the world are calling for a royal commission. And the prime minister actually said, if got into government, that they would conduct a royal commission into COVID. Now they're backing out of it, or trying to back out of it, because of the exposure of both the Labor government and the previous Liberal government to the negligence, the absolute negligence that's occurred at government levels with regard to looking after the Australian population and keeping them protected and keeping them safe. So these senators are calling for a royal commission, and there was an opportunity on the 1st of February for us to present in the Senate our terms of reference for a broad-based royal commission, because we don't want the government to determine the terms of reference, because when they do, they'll be so narrow, we won't never get to the truth about what's been happening. So if people have a look at the, I think it's on the on YouTube, terms of reference, and the it went for 7 hours during the entire day, in which various organisations, including AMPS and organisations that I was representing as well, headed up by a lawyer by the name of Julian Gillespie, number of experts on the panel presenting our arguments for particular terms of references. And that means examining every aspect of the management of the pandemic in Australia, because it was a disaster, an absolute disaster. It's turned Australia into a land of poverty, where people can't afford to eat, people can't afford to buy, young people can't afford to buy a home. They don't realise that there was over $500 billion wasted on this pandemic, and the ongoing costs of sickness and illness and people who are not productive anymore, people who can't work because of the adverse effects of the vaccines, that the level of destruction of our culture and society has been unbelievable. And people are still picking on one another for being vaccinated and for being unvaccinated, when the people are innocent of all of this. They were made, I call it the most heinous crime in human history, to inject an experimental, unproven, unsafe drug into the entire population, not only a genetic material, a viral genetic material that's synthetic, but wrapped up in a lipid nanoparticle. And lipid nanoparticles don't break down. They're highly inflammatory. They cross the blood-brain barrier. They go into your brain. They go into your heart. They go into your testicles. You go into your ovaries and your eggs. These lipid nanoparticles are extremely dangerous, but not only are they carrying the messenger RNA to produce the spike protein, which is also toxic, and there's no way of switching off the production of the spike protein once it's in your cells, but the lipid nanoparticles carry in each injection tens of billions of particles of DNA, the blueprint of life, DNA. It's not just mRNA, it's DNA, the nucleic acids that make up our genes. And we know that these are now able to be carried into the nucleus of our cells in our bodies. So we don't know. God, nature, whatever, we just don't know what's going to happen. There may be no long-term effects, but that's not the case in my life, where people are coming to me saying, so-and-so died, so-and-so got cancer, so-and-so's cancer's come back, it's come back with a vengeance.
Well the increased mortality rates themselves require some serious investigation. I mean, I know that the mortality in Australia is something like 165,000 every year. It kind of tracks along at what you would expect for the percentage of the population. And in 2022 and 23, that jumped up to 190,000, which is a 30,000 people jump. And you kind of have to wonder what is going on here. But Ian, my concern is this. I mean, we were talking before we started this conversation about a forum that was run by the Australian government in April 2022. And this was the head of the health department, Professor Brendan Murphy, the head of the Australian Medical Officer and Deputy Medical Officer, Paul Kidd, Michael Kelly, the head of the TGA, Professor John Skerritt. And this was a forum, and I'm quoting, for early treatment of COVID. Now, this was 22 months after COVID first appeared, so I wouldn't exactly call it early treatment. But anyway, the only thing that these key opinion leaders and product champions, I would argue, talked about was five or six newly patented drugs. Not a mention about natural immunity, which is another word that I that kind of stopped existing during the pandemic. Apparently, if you claimed natural immunity was an issue, you were a heretic. You could have almost been disbarred from practicing. I mean, these are the people that are going to be determining the scope of the Royal Commission, really, aren't they?
Well, hopefully not.
Hopefully not, Aisha. This is your namesake, Ian, Bright Hope. You know, there's something there, isn't it? You live by that. But I do share a bit of I have a bit of concern about that.
Well, I do too. But there's not a single person in this country at those levels who is qualified, trained, and experienced in nutritional immunology or nutritional medicine. Mm. There's nobody. It is the most important approach to maintaining the individual's health and the health of the community and the population. Not one skerrick of information was given to the public about how you can improve your resistance to this virus, this flu-like virus, cause no symptoms in the majority of people and serious problems in a very small and very susceptible few.
Well, I remember, Ian, when you, I mean, you know, in the, as I mentioned in the introduction, you are the founder and president and a lecturer from the Australasian College of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine, and you drafted up some letters, which I was very proud to co-sign as president at the time. But we sent letters. Tell us about what you basically sent to and who you sent it to and what the response was.
Well, I started the trouble there, Ron. But a lot of other people joined me,
with good reason. But go on. I think a lot of listeners would not be aware of this.
Well, before it was even claimed to be a pandemic, I wrote a letter to the health minister, and I copied it to the prime minister and the chief medical officer, the AMA, the RACGP, and others, because I suspected that there was something wrong with a virus that was all of a sudden just came out of the blue, when we know that the virologists in these laboratories around the world are playing with weaponized and gain-of-function viruses. So I suspected something was wrong way back then, as I have with every other so-called pandemic when they're badly managed. So I thought we have decent people in our leaders, and I wrote appealing that they consider the use of vitamin D as a defensive mechanism. And I provided references for it. I suggested everybody be put on a CD zinc campaign, which is vitamin C, which kills the viruses, as well as supports the immune system. And zinc, which is also very, very important in so many biochemical pathways in our body, especially in the immune system and the production of antibodies. And I thought that was a reasonable thing to do. No response from any of them. I got a response from the AMA, but it wasn't very satisfactory. I wrote also to the unions and business leaders saying that we don't need to do these strange things like lockdowns and whatever. I wrote a number of letters. There was no responses from any of them. And I thought, this is bizarre. And what's going on? And then, of course, it got worse. And the messaging and the narrative from the government and the government officers got worse and worse and worse. And I thought, this is not right. We should be isolating and quarantining those who are at risk and letting everybody catch the virus, because it's like every other cold-like virus. It is a cold-like virus. It's not even a flu-like. It's not even a flu virus. Let them catch it, and get natural immunity. Make sure that they've got their vitamin D levels up to a reasonable level. They easily test, do a blood test, and the GPs could do a blood test, measure the blood levels of vitamin D, and if the vitamin D levels were low, then supplement. If they're very low, give them a little injection of vitamin D. It's painless, virtually, and back to normality. Let them go out, catch the virus. They probably not even know they've got it. And then induce natural immunity, which means you've got immunity from the mucus, which is healthy and just knocks off the virus, to the deepest cells in your body, because that's where the vitamin D goes to. Vitamin D is the sunlight vitamin. So basically it takes the vitamin D made in the skin from the sun exposure to the deepest cells in your body, so that you've got a mechanism of defense at every level, in every organ and tissue of your body. That is profound. It's long-lasting. And as you know, Ron, our immune system has memory cells. So when you get exposed to the coronavirus the next time, bang, you reject it pretty well straight away, because you've got IgA antibodies in your mucus. And IgA antibodies will never occur in your mucus from injecting a vaccine into your skin, especially one that doesn't have the proper antigens and is only messenger RNA. I'll say it again, a toxic genetic therapy. So
I think a lot of people, Ian, don't realise that even as they're going through their boosters, they're still part of a phase 4 clinical trial.
It's a clinical trial. It's a dangerous drug.
Yes, I know. I mean, you normally get disclaimers, you know, you normally get told, you know, we're not responsible for, you know, X, Y, Z, but this is still a phase 4 clinical trial because we don't know the long-term effects of this, which is another story. But go on. Sorry, I interrupted.
You know, if I was still practicing, and I'm not, I'm retired, but if I was practicing, I would tell people don't take it because it's experimental. If you can't have, if you're not told exactly what it is, how it's manufactured, what's in it, what are the side effects, what are the possible side effects, and make sure you get full informed, free consent from your doctor, then don't take that drug. Because if you don't know what it's going to do to you, don't take it. And this was a new platform, a brand new platform, but it was not a brand new platform when you look at the history of it. It's been around for 20 years. Messenger RNA has not been shown to be effective in any real disease of mankind. It's not been shown to be safe, but they used it. And here comes the conspiracy theories, and a lot of the conspiracy theories are coming into fruition as conspiracy facts.
Well, Ian, I would argue beyond a conspiracy theory, it was an extremely good, in fact, I think one of the greatest business models in human history, because there's a thing called emergency use authorization, which was the key. I mean, I remember getting a response from the TGA to your letter, our letter, and saying, there is no evidence to show.
You wrote it, but I didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah. Well, I'm very proud to be part of it. I really was. And you sent 50 references from referee journals. This was not a light paper. This was a really, I thought, a very great scientific paper. I was really proud to put my name to it. Humbled, in fact. But the TGA wrote back saying, "Oh, there's no evidence to show this will have any effect on." In other words, this is no evidence to show that natural immunity will have any effect on the virus or the response to the virus. That was essentially what they were saying. There was no evidence to show that natural immunity would have any effect on the virus. Extraordinary statement. But coming back to, and I want to preface one other thing about the TGA. They got two or three articles from the manufacturer on the antivirals like Paxlovid and Molnupiravir, and apparently that was more than enough to rush it through. But coming back to emergency use authorization, because you're talking about side effects and the beauty of, and this is something I don't think a lot of people know either, The beauty of having an emergency use authorization on your product is that you absolve the all liability.
Yes, precisely. I mean, the vaccine manufacturers have been absolved of litigation and immunity against litigation since 1986, I think, when it was President Nixon actually gave them the go-ahead because the vaccine manufacturers said, we're getting sued by too many people for side effects and deaths as a consequence of the vaccines. So we're not going to make any more. So they actually blackmailed the government into giving them immunity against prosecution and liability. And so, therefore, these manufacturers just rub their hands in glee. We can manufacture products that don't have to necessarily be of high quality. We've shown that the COVID vaccines, Comirnaty and Moderna, are not of high quality. They contain contaminants, that is the DNA, and also endotoxin from the bacteria that make the mRNA. Very hardy, toxic substances that can kill people and shock people. So they've got away with it. And it's, as you say, the greatest business model that's ever been designed because you can make people sick with these things and then you come out with new drugs such as the anti-cancer drugs that they're coming out with now because their vaccines have been causing these cancers and they've got something else to treat their cancers with. Mm. So I believe that this cartel, this monopoly that they've got has to stop. Hmm. Otherwise, we are going to continue building mRNA factories here in Australia and Canada and elsewhere, and we're going to be producing mRNA that will be going into not only our us as adults, but our children, in our food supply, in our beef, our pork, our chicken, everywhere. Because they think this technology is going to save the world. This technology is going to cause more pollution than anything that you can imagine. Let's say, Ron, you and I have got pesticide and herbicide residues in us. Yes, we know that. We know that we've got heavy metal residues in our systems. We now know that our cells, inside our cells, we can have microplastics. Well, what happens when these lipid nanoparticles don't break down very easily, go into the environment. And the spike protein or the breakdown products of the spike protein are going into the environment. This is a protein that is made by the mRNA. It has never, ever, ever existed in nature. So how in God's name is nature going to handle it? We just don't know. As I said before, this is the most heinous experiment on humankind, but also on the rest of the world. On the rest of life on this planet, the end of my career, I never thought anything like this would ever occur, Ron. But there is a very dark side to humanity, and this dark side is driving these experimental vaccines, these experimental genetic substances into the population. Mm. Why? Well, if you look at the WHO, the World Health Organization. It gets funded by people who want to make a lot of money, people who are making vaccines, investing in vaccines, and it's also associated very closely with the World Economic Forum, common memberships, etc. And the World Economic Forum was started in the early 1970s. It was dreamed up by a cabal of individuals who put a particular person in charge to develop it and grow it, who is clearly a Marxist or a neo-Marxist and basically somebody who wants to set up a one-world government. That's what the objective of the World Economic Forum is one-world government. And this is the way they're trying to achieve it, through control of the population, through the World Health Organization compliance, especially of the West, to vaccines, treatments, lockdowns, and the rest. So we know that the World Economic Forum head, Mr. Klaus Schwab, he is the nephew of a Nazi. He and others are proud to admit they believe in eugenicists, They believe in eugenicism, whatever it's called, and that is population control. Some of the wealthy have claimed that vaccination will actually be used to reduce the world's population. I'm not going to mention names. People can look up the names. They're very, very well-known names, billionaires who don't care about individuals. They care about power and money and influence. And this is the as I wrote in one of my my Substacks, it's the dark, very dark underbelly of humanity. And we do need to look at ourselves as spiritual beings and come back to beliefs and a philosophy of life that everything should be good and clear and pure. We should be devoid of the seven deadly sins and look to either philosophy or religion or belief in something that's bigger and better than ourselves and try to aspire to that, because money and power and one world governments mean we're going to end up being enslaved. And we were in prison, and I call it imprisonment when we were locked down. And if you lived in Melbourne, like I do, you actually look in the eyes of those who locked us down, and these people are pure evil. I'm sure there's some good in some of the leaders, but they are taking orders from directly or indirectly from the WEF, the World Economic Forum, and the World Health Organization in terms of managing our pandemics, our lockdowns, and the injections. And Klaus Schwab has said quite categorically that we will own nothing, but we will be happy.
Yes.
Well, that's not the way it is, Mr. Schwab. You're not going to win because humanity is far stronger than your beliefs in your neo-Marxist system of control.
Well, you know, Ian, I mean, I've been following this story of the influence of industry, and I did a podcast on it where I actually had the speech given by Eisenhower, of all people, the former general of the armed forces in the Second World War, who'd been president for 8 years, came out with a statement a little bit late, I think. He'd already retired, just retired, saying the thing we have to fear most is the unsolicited influence of the industrial military complex. That was in 1961. I did a whole podcast on that quote. And I've been following this story for all of my professional life. And so I've written about it, and I'm aware of it. But even I was shocked by the extent of that influence, which I now extend beyond chemical, food, and pharmaceutical industry to media and government, all acting as one, almost literally, with the same message, literally word for word, the same message. So it was almost scripted. And I think this was coming back to our discussion about natural immunity. And I want to remind, the reason an emergency use authorization is given, you know, we were kind of congratulated. Isn't it great? It used to take 5 or 10 years for a vaccine to get approved. We got this through so quickly. How good are we? Well, if there is an alternative treatment to a condition like natural immunity, like vitamin D, zinc, magnesium, vitamin C, ivermectin, dare I say, ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine and a combination of all of those, if there was a treatment for the said condition, then there is no emergency use authorization. There is no immunity from liability. So this is part of the whole story. This is, you know, I ask people, when I say the word to you, ivermectin, what do you think of? And 9 out of 10 people will say, oh, that's the horse dewormer.
Yeah.
ignoring that it won the Nobel Prize for medicine in humans.
Yeah. I mean, it's a substance that was derived from the soil fungus in Japan. As you said, the discoverer's got the Nobel Prize for it.
It's in 2015.
Yeah, billions and billions of doses have been used in Africa to prevent killer diseases and serious diseases like river blindness and elephantitis, and many, many other parasitic infections. But you mentioned the military-industrial complex, Ron. It's the military-industrial pharma complex now. And you could also add, as you said before, food and media. But they're all in lockstep. All the governments are in lockstep. You know why? Because they've all been infiltrated. They've all been infiltrated by, again, the great reset man, Klaus Schwab from the WEF. And he is just another a puppet of the real dark underbelly of humanity, those who really, really want control. And they are the wealthy banking families, the extreme wealthy banking families that we don't see anything of. These people are puppets. Our politicians are puppets as well. They're puppets of the WEF and they're puppets of the World Health Organization, as are bureaucrats, because they can't think for themselves. They're told what to do. Because this WEF and WHO, they've been established for a long time, and they have psychologists working with them who know how to manipulate the human mind, manipulate the human behavior and human responses to situations. And the best thing you can do, as Adolf Hitler's propagandist Eichmann said many, many times, all you have to do is repeat a lie many, many, many times and the population will believe it. Mm. And we were told the biggest lie, that this virus was a killer virus and that was going to kill us all or kill 50% of the population. So many tens of millions of people, from the epidemiologists in the UK. It was all rubbish. It was all rubbish. But the media were caught up in it as well. The media have a lot to answer for. And that includes our national media. They're all being told by, again, it came from the WHO and the manipulators within the organisations attached to the WHO through the British Broadcast Commission, BBC, that formed the Trusted Media Initiative, or the TMI as it's known. And the Trusted Media Initiative is, we have a message, we have the narrative, we will tell you the truth. And everybody falls into lockstep. So all of the media around the world followed in the Trusted Media Initiative, including our ABC.
Yes, no. I was shocked. I'm not sure that he's a banker. I know he's involved in other things, but I do know that Bill Gates has a huge influence on the WHO, both in funding and influence. But on another note, if I reflect on a public health, stepping away from the pandemic now, if I reflect on public health over the last 40 years and the trajectory that it's taken during our careers, Ian, I'm going to make a statement where the medical profession, and I think, you know, there are some amazing people in the medical profession and some amazing procedures that are life-saving, incredible technology, incredible knowledge. I've been the beneficiary of that. So that's the caveat I put on my next statement, which is that I think the medical profession have unwittingly presided over the worst epidemic in preventable chronic diseases in human history. What would be your response to that statement?
I agree with you, Ron.
Well, you know, Ian, you've been lecturing for 40 plus years on improving natural immunity, which is something we were all taught in undergraduate training as doctors, dentists, anybody doing a science degree or a health degree would have been talking about biochemistry and physiology, which is exactly what you've been lecturing on for 40 years. Why hasn't that message been more embraced?
Because of opposition to it. When you're playing a game, you play the ball, you don't play the man. Ad hominem is what is characteristic of our professions, where if you come in with something a little different, a different idea about things as an undergraduate or as a postgraduate, they shun you. You're an outcast. You become you don't appeal to your peers anymore. Most doctors and dentists are highly conformists in terms of their behavior. They will tick all the right boxes, say all the right things so that they can climb their professional ladders and get to the top. If you don't do that, you're left down at the bottom somewhere, or you're kicked out completely, like they tried to do with me and others who had different ideas about how healthcare should be managed.
And did to many during the pandemic too, who had the audacity to suggest natural immunity was worth pursuing.
Yeah. Well, even if you had a prescription for ivermectin, the horse paste, which saved lives, including people who were sick in hospital, and I can guarantee that because I've got colleagues in, for example, in Africa who use it all the time for the severe diseases in Africa, and they found that people who took the ivermectin didn't get COVID and die, or if they were given ivermectin in hospital, they're out of hospital very quickly. You know, it's just.
$2.50 for a 5-day course, Ian. Yeah. Not good. Not good. I mean, that's not good economics.
Not good for business. No.
Whereas Paxlovid and Molnupiravir was $500, $600, $700 for a 5-day course. But I digress for a moment. Sorry.
Yeah. No, you digress, but it's a good digression. Mm. I think coming back to
why isn't it more embraced and the whole approach is the question.
The public have embraced it. When I started, Blackmores, the vitamin manufacturer, would not go into a pharmacy because they said the pharmacy will pollute our philosophy because we are herbal, we are natural. But I insisted that they go into pharmacy. At one stage, I spoke to Marcus Blackmore and said, I'm not but people who go to the pharmacy for their medication. I want the pharmacy to have your product there. So, I mean, broke that difficult situation, and now you can see them everywhere. They're in grocery and supermarkets. They're everywhere. So the public know what works. The public know what's good for them, and the public are voting with their feet. And so my profession has been left behind. Unfortunately, they have been quite obnoxious. The leaders are quite obnoxious. In fact, there's been no leadership in medical profession for a very, very long time. And we know why, because they are conflicted. The various colleges and associations are all part of Big Pharma. They either get funding directly or indirectly from Pharma. So they're not going to break that mold. They're not going to say, look, we're going to go natural now, because it's not part of the business model. The business model was established by Rockefeller and others in the 1930s when they went into the universities and said, we will fund your medical schools, providing you research and develop our drugs. And the drugs, of course, based on petrochemicals. Okay? That's where a lot of drugs come from. So that was the start of the pharma medical model.
I think it got a real kick start in after 1980, where a lot of universities were said, you have to find your own funding now and things have to be commercially viable or, for you to justify your research. So in other words, you have to make money from what you're doing. And good health, as our dear friend Andrew Saltz once said, good health makes sense, but it doesn't make dollars.
Yes. Yes. God rest his soul.
Mm-hmm. But Ian, I once did a podcast with Professor Julia Ruckledge from New Zealand, and she said something to me once which made me stop, and I'm repeating this again. And she said, it's perfectly natural for doctors to be skeptical, curious and skeptical. It's perfectly natural. And I said, I agree with you there. My question would be, at what point of their education does that curiosity kick in? Because in my experience, we just got over those subjects like anatomy, physiology, biochemistry. I mean, God, who needs to learn those pathways? They're just so irritating. Get me into pathology and pharmacology where I can identify a disease and I know what to prescribe for it. That's where medicine really is at. I mean, I don't think the curiosity kicks in early enough.
I loved all the basic sciences, right? But when it came to looking after human beings, the wrong questions were being asked. My background was in egg science. I did research on animal nutrition. I knew what made animals healthy. I knew what stopped the diseases in animals. Or crops and pastures and plants. Sometimes you can't grow plants on soils that are deficient in trace elements, and sometimes you grow sheep on and cattle on soils that are deficient in selenium, and they end up with white muscle disease and cardiomegaly and all of these other things. You know, I think people should have a broader education and a wider education. I keep on saying, you know, you take a child, you send it to kindergarten, then for 6 years they're in primary school, 6 years they're in secondary school, 6 years they're at university studying medicine, then another 3 to 4 years or even more to specialise. They've got very little experience in the wider world. And you don't ask questions, you don't challenge the teaching when you go through medicine. You accept what your professors say. So this inquisitiveness disappears very, very quickly. If you're going to tick the boxes, you stop asking the difficult questions. And if that's the case, you'd stop asking the difficult questions. You come out the other end, it's like a sausage machine. You just do what you're told to do. You follow the protocols. And you don't think for yourself, you know. And when somebody, for example, takes a medical journal and says to the ear surgeon, for example, look, there's a study here to show that if you take children off dairy products, they don't get glue ear anymore and middle ear infections. And that surgeon's not interested in that because he wants to operate on the middle ear and put grommets in or take the tonsils out and the adenoids. And I mean, they're blind to any alternatives. They're blind to the possibility that a basic building block like vitamin D, for example, can prevent infection.
Hmm.
Not only that, but prevent certain cancers.
Maybe. You know, you've heard of John Ioannidis, Professor John Ioannidis from Stanford. I mean, I think to put it in perspective for our listener, if you write an article and you get cited 1,000 times, that's just incredible. John Ioannidis has been cited 200,000 times, and he made the point that evidence-based medicine is difficult to distinguish from evidence-based marketing. So I would argue that doctors who are so overwhelmed with not only patients, but the bombardment of information, that the influence of industry is a story that's very easy to miss, but once you hear it, very difficult to ignore.
Precisely. I mean, Ioannidis was spot on with regard to this pandemic as well. As an epidemiologist, he should not have been ignored, but that's not being in lockstep with the rest of the world and being doing what you're being instructed to do from the powers that be outside of the country. And my fear now, Ron, is with regard to the international health regulations and the changes to those, that we, if Australia signs up to them, agrees to them, then we are probably going to lose our health sovereignty. That is, we as a country and we as individuals will not be able to determine whether or not we're going to take a particular drug, because they will force it upon us. And that is not far away from us at the moment. People here who I'm working with as well, lawyers and others, to try and convince the governments not to go ahead and sign up to this so-called treaty.
And this is a WHO initiative, isn't it?
It is the World Health Organization initiative. It's the international health regulations. And it was voted up recently by the World Health Council, World Health Association, I think it's, that it would be accepted. And they shortened the amount of time the countries had to consider it to about 10 months from about 18 months. So they're trying to rush it through. And there's opposition to it. There's a number of countries, including New Zealand, who are not going to sign up to it. So hopefully a lot more will refuse to sign up to it, and they won't be able to pass it. But I don't have very much confidence in their federal politicians in this country. I think Klaus Schwab has been very successful when he said, we will penetrate every cabinet, that means every parliament in the world, and he's been very successful at doing that.
What are the implications? I mean, it's not just the politicians, I'm afraid. I think it's the key opinion leaders and product champions who lead our health departments, et cetera. But what are the implications of signing this treaty, just so we're clear on that?
The implications are that it will give the World Health Organization the authority to determine the management of pandemics internationally, and every nation who signed up to it will follow the instructions from the World Health Organization. And we know that the World Health Organization gave advice to our leaders that it was important to lock down. it was important to mask up. Masks don't work with viruses like this. It was important to put these plastic shields up, important to stop close the schools, put masks on children, all of these instructions and recommendations from the WHO. And also we wait until we get a vaccine, but we use the drugs that they're recommending. And of course, the drug companies have major influence on the WHO because it's all part of the funding. The future is when there is a pandemic, and they keep on calling it pandemic. The biggest epidemic or pandemic we've got in the world is obesity, diabetes, obesity. These things are real pandemics, and they're costing us a fortune. They will determine the actions of the countries with regard to all of the things I've just mentioned, like the lockdowns.
Mm.
But also they will determine what we take in terms of medicines. And we will be forced to take the vaccine like we were forced last time. But the next time, it could be even worse, and that is physical force. Not just a few people, a small percentage, are being vaccine refusers, deniers, but everybody will be injected and or given the drugs that the WHO are wanting to force on us. And if we continue to be sleepwalking to this neo-Marxist state, then everybody just sit down and do nothing. Keep on watching your television and enjoying your life, because the situation that we're finding ourselves in now has been created by these people at the WEF and WHO and our leaders, mistakenly by our leaders, pushing us into huge debt with regard to the cost of the pandemic, which has been the early couple of years was just under $500 billion, which is $500 billion. And we've got a debt. We've got to pay off the interest. And where is that going? It's again going to the wealthy, the bankers, where we borrow the money from. They sucked a lot of money out of the country when we bought those useless vaccines. And we have a population of people who are sicker and sicker and sicker. So many on the NDIS, so many can't work. Our productivity levels have sunken. We know that. We've been told that. We've got to lift our productivity levels. People are becoming homeless. They can't afford their mortgages. People are living in the streets. Young people who should be able to afford a deposit for a home can't afford a deposit for a home. So now the people in Parliament here in Victoria are putting on somebody to at $500,000 a year to create more homes, social housing. Where is he going to get the raw materials from? There are already shortages of raw material. We're talking about a couple of 100,000 homes, I think.
Mm. Ian, if we were now, just want to finish on a positive note here, because
we can't, Ron. Sorry, you got there.
That wasn't in the brief, was it? No. But let's be positive, because they're probably health practitioners and or people who are listening, thinking, "Gee, I wish my doctor was changing his way of or her way of approaching health." So let's start with doctors. I want you to give us some advice for doctors and for patients. If a doctor was wanting to change the way they approached health, rather than prescription based manage chronic disease, what would you suggest they do?
I would suggest the doctor leave the AMA, leave the RACGP, and join the Australian Medical Professional Society, which is an organisation that's growing. It's an organisation that's awake to what's happening. It's an organisation that believes in bodily autonomy. It's an organisation that believes in full and informed consent. It's a body of doctors who believe in healthcare that's not necessarily filling out protocols. They are association with a lot of very good relationships with other organisations, including public organisations and professional organisations. They were the ones who published the book, Too Many Dead. They are the doctors who really care. And I have friends still practising, and they're scratching their heads about what's going on. They don't know what's going on. The AMPS and associated organisations can help them to learn about what's going on, help to learn about better healthcare, refer people to ACNAM and AMA and other organisations that are doing the training, retraining doctors, to think about how medicine can be practiced as a science and as an art, and not just as a super salesman for the pharmaceutical industry, because health is more than drugs and surgery and radiotherapy. Health is a lot more than that. And the general public are waking up to it. The general public are talking about healthcare. They're talking about mind-body medicine and nutrition and the right sort of herbal medicines and supplements to take for various conditions and prevention of this, that, and the other condition. Not to say that modern medicine, as you mentioned before, has got some very, very, very high effective technologies for serious illness and disease. But let's try to keep the population healthier and stop making the drug companies richer, because the time has come, I think, for us to observe that inflection point in history where I think the pharma industry has overstepped its mark with regard to its activities in our society and culture by injecting this genetic toxic substance into the population.
Well, Ian, that's a note to finish on, and we'll have links to your Substack, because I think people might like to hear more about your opinions and what you're up to in the Royal Commission. So, Ian, thank you again for joining me today, sharing your wisdom and knowledge, and thank you for everything you've done in terms of promoting natural immunity and public health. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Ron, and I'd like to thank your listeners as well, because it's not an easy subject to listen to, and you've done a great job conducting this interview, and I respect your opinion enormously. So thank you.
Thanks. Well, there's always so much to think about when I talk to, well, any of my guests, but particularly Ian, who always has an interesting perspective on things, got me thinking. I mean, he was using the term Marxist and neo-Marxist. Well, I had to go and look that up, because my knowledge of political theory is not great. Marxism is a social, economic, and political philosophy that analyzes the impact of the ruling class on the laborers, leading to an uneven distribution of wealth privileges in the society. It stimulates the workers to protest the injustice. How interesting. I mean, I had heard that the 20 wealthiest people in the world earned more in the 3 years of the pandemic than they did in the 20 years before that. So that's an interesting one. And neo-Marxist, I wasn't quite sure what the difference there was, believed that power in society is not merely held by those owning the means of production, but also by those who control the superstructure. This includes institutions like the media, education, legal systems which help propagate the ideology and culture of the ruling class. Well, I'd certainly agree with that, in the sense that I've always been aware of the chemical, food, and pharmaceutical industry's influence, but I would add media to that. And interestingly, although Ian alluded to the control of bankers, and I don't actually share the idea that it's a population thing, because that we're trying to reduce the population, because one of the things that I think is the success of the pharmaceutical business model, which, as I've said repeatedly, is worth US $1.5 trillion, there are two criteria, and I think this is relevant to Ian's point about depopulation. There are two things that a pharmaceutical industry does not want to do. One, it doesn't want to cure anyone, because then they lose a customer. And two, it doesn't want to kill anyone, because again, they lose a customer. So I'm not sure that reducing the population, reducing your customer base, if you like, is conducive to the business model, which we are all subject to. And interestingly, when we talk about WHO funding, I found this interesting article. Currently, WHO has full control over only about a quarter of its budget. WHO therefore isn't and can't set the global health agenda, and has had to do the bidding of rich donors, which only rich nations in Europe and North America, but also not only rich nations in Europe and North America, but also rich philanthropists like the Gates Foundation. Over the years, the billionaire philanthropists, the Gates Foundation, have become WHO's second biggest donor, making the health agency heavily dependent on their support to keep functioning. Now, I'm always intrigued by Bill Gates and his claim to try to improve global health, because if I had as many billions of dollars as Bill Gates had, the most obvious thing I would do would be provide clean water and sewage for the 2 billion people in the world that don't have it. And immediately, I would improve global health overnight. But no, the focus has been on vaccines. And I believe Gates has invested over $1 billion in vaccines. And I say invest because I believe the return on that investment has been tenfold at least. So there's a lot going on there. It's a story that is very easy to miss, as is the case for many, many busy health practitioners who are inundated with chronic disease, patients in the waiting room requiring their attention, being bombarded by what is supposedly evidence-based medicine and is in fact, according to the most cited researcher in the world, Professor John Ioannidis, is actually evidence-based marketing. It's a story that's easy to miss, but once you hear it, it's a story that's difficult to ignore. With that, I hope this finds you well. Until next time, this is Dr. Ron Ehrlich. Be well.
This podcast provides general information and discussion about medicine, health, and related subjects. The content is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice or as a substitute for care by a qualified medical practitioner. If you or any other person has a medical concern, he or she should consult with an appropriately qualified medical practitioner. Guests who speak in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions.